All right. Good morning, everybody. It is 11:17 now on October 4th, Monday, October 4th. Happy Monday. And we're going to pick it up where we left off with free radical reactions. And we left off with one of my favorite subjects. We were talking about bromination and the differences between bromination and chlorination. And I said last time that was the argument wasn't as important as the knowledge that bromination is more selective than chlorination. And so we'll pick it up with that. Let's start a new note here. Free radical reactions. And this is just sort of the punchline of what we found last time, that if we start with something that has tertiary, secondary, primary positions, and we do chlorination, Cl2 and light, that what we get is a series of products where the chlorination happens in multiple locations. And we can get chlorination out on the other primary spots as well. I'm just going to use this one primary position to sort of like stand in for all of them. And what we said is that the relative rates was about 5.2 to 3.9 to 1. So if we use that primary as being the relative rate of that substrate, and if we do that same reaction and we do it bromination with light, that the difference is 50. So it becomes 1640, I believe. Let me get back to the number. 1640, 82, and 1. In terms of the relative rates. And so this reaction is much more selective. It's going to be greater than 90%, and that this is the major product. And when we look at chlorination like that this is probably only going to be, it's 5.2 to 1. I mean, we're lucky, I think, if that is greater than 50% in terms of that 5.2. And so it's really about bromination, where bromination is far more selective. But be aware too that what it's choosing for, what it's being selective for, is it's being selective for the stability of the free radical. So when we look at this reaction and we look at bromination, where we left off was this mechanism that showed that we went from here to a free radical. To the next, I think this goes all the way down, something like this. And so we start off with the proton and the bromine radical. And then we've got bromine H and the carbon free radical. And then eventually the bromine, because Br2 is sitting in here as well, that goes on to that next part, and we've still got BRH that's floating around with that. And it is the stability of the free radical. It is this piece right here that determines the transition state and the stability of the transition state and this activation energy. And so the most critical thing is that what we see is that whatever makes the free radical more stable makes the reaction faster. Whatever makes the free radical less stable that in turn is going to slow the reaction down.
So is chlorination significantly faster than bromination?
No, it's, well, I guess we could say because the activation energy is much smaller that the chlorination does proceed at a faster rate. Yes, I guess I would say that, that chlorination should proceed at a faster rate than bromination. However, the bromination is far more selective because of the stability of the free radical. But the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, when we look at stability, what we look at is primary versus secondary versus tertiary. And we would say that the tertiary is far more stable than a primary or a secondary. But what's really critical to understand there is that if you have something that is, that looks like this, let me put a tertiary position in here. And this is one way to do it. And I look at this and I look at the free radical here versus the free radical in this position, that this one is far more stable. And the reason is it's benzylic with resonance. So we would look at this and we would say that's secondary and this is tertiary. But in reality, this is secondary benzylic. And that benzylic part means that it has resonance. And so it's not enough. It's not enough to look at primary versus secondary versus tertiary. You have to also consider resonance when you're considering free radicals and when you're considering free radical bromination. And it's very important to look at other free radical stabilizing groups that can introduce resonance. All right, hang on a second. My washing machine is tearing itself apart and there's nobody in the house to go get it. So hang on one second, I gotta go get it. Okay, disaster averted. My washing machine was walking across the kitchen floor and about to tear the electrical plug out of the socket, as they do when they are unbalanced and deciding that they're going to throw a fit. They have a mind of their own. Okay. All the fun of teaching from home. It's just the way things go. Okay, so what we need to do now is we need to talk stereochemistry for a minute. And then we'll get into some other ideas here. So what we did was regioselectivity, now stereoselectivity. which is to say that there isn't any. when we do a bromination, and we brominate this with light, what we find is that we get racemic. We get plus minus whenever we create a stereocenter. And the reason is, if we look at that mechanism and we watch what happens with that mechanism, that when we abstract the proton, actually that's the second step. Let's go with the first step first. Light comes in, strikes this, splits it apart. We get the two free radicals. The free radical then abstracts the proton. And of the two protons, the protons are enantiotopic, HA and HB. Enantiotopic means that if I replace one, I get one enantiomer. If I replace the other, I get the other enantiomer. And so they are prochiral, is a way to say that, all these nice terms that we've got, enantiotopic, prochiral. So if we pull either one of these protons, what winds up happening is we create the free radical. And the free radical is trigonal planar, sp2. Trigonal planar. And so this thing really exists to look this way. Put the proton there, and the free radical sits in a p orbital, unhybridized p orbital. And that then, when it goes to react with the bromide, can react from above to pick up the bromine, or it can pick up from below. And because it can pick up from either thing, just like a carbocation can, because it acts just like a carbocation, we wind up generating racemic. And we get both enantiomers. And if we have a tertiary position, and that tertiary position is a stereocenter. I think I need one more carbon on there. And we go through and we brominate this. And it brominates in the tertiary position, even though that tertiary position is a stereocenter. And this may be, let's see, what do I have? 1, 2, 3. This is an S. No, that's an R enantiomer. Even though this is an R enantiomer, what I create is the racemic. And it racemizes it because it goes through the sp2 trigonal planar intermediate for the free radical. And so just like carbocations, we get equal chance of approach from above and from below the plane. Okay. All right, from there, we look at this resonance a little bit. And we've been talking about how resonance can help to stabilize free radicals. That takes us to a topic of allylic halogenation. In allylic halogenation, what we do is we look at the bromination of an allylic position. So Br2, light, and here what winds up happening is it brominates next to the double bond, and we get a little bit of this guy too. So this is the allylic bromination. and this is the bromination. And we wind up seeing both. The major is the allylic bromination. And we'll talk about how we can prevent this guy from happening, how we can prevent the bromination from happening. But let's look at the mechanism of how this reaction works. So when we have a double bond like this, the first thing is the bromine generates the free radical by being hit by the light. That homolytically cleaves the bond, generating bromine free radical. The bromine free radical then seeks to act as a base and pull a proton. And the most stable free radical that it can generate is by pulling a proton which is in the allylic position. So these are allylic protons. In pulling those protons, we make the allylic free radical. And then that free radical has free radical resonance. And that's the big deal. That's what makes the difference. From there, that free radical reacts with another Br2 and brominates. And because of the symmetry of the molecule, it doesn't matter which position it brominates in, it brominates allylically. It brominates in the allylic position to the double bond. And so it's an extremely useful reaction in that we can functionalize double bonds without destroying the double bond. The double bond persists. We just brominate next to the double bond. Now, the other reaction that we've seen, this is very similar, and you have to watch the other reaction. The other reaction that we've seen is where we don't use light and we just use Br2. This is the bromination reaction. And this brominates in the anti-fashion to give me the dibromo. And that works, if we look at that reaction, that works by the double bond reaching out, this thing turning back, binding to it, kicking out the bromide, and goes through the cyclic bromonium ion. And then the bromide, as an anion, comes back in and does an SN2 reaction, kicking out that guy. So the difference between these two, the big difference, is light. And that one goes through free radical and the other does not. And yet we know that there's a lot of bromide that is floating around in solution that is unreacted, because that's the mechanism here, is that the free radical, the carbon free radical, turns around and reacts with Br2 again. And so if there is Br2 that is floating around, even when there's light there, I'm still going to get some of this competing bromination reaction. So as I said, the question is, how do I eliminate this? How do I get rid of this thing and not do this dibromination? And the answer is, well, we don't use Br2, we use something else.
And could you use more intense light so that there's less time for the alternate product to form?
In theory, but the easier thing to do is just to not use Br2, to avoid the electrophilic addition. So here's how we do that. to avoid the electrophilic addition. We use a reagent called NBS. NBS is N-bromosuccinimide. So this is N-bromosuccinimide. And I think I've got one INO too much. And what it does is when we react it with light, the light comes in and strikes this bond, and it fragments the bond in much the same way. Much the same way as with bromine, except that this free radical is unreactive that it generates. And then it generates some of the bromine radical. So when we do this, we're getting the bromine free radical, and the reaction mechanism can proceed such that now the proton is pulled. And then with another N-bromosuccinimide, it can donate the bromine. And you may be wondering, where does this free radical keep going? Well, that free radical keeps going in a chain reaction where it tends to act as the base. It is what continues to go on and propagate and pull.
Can you scroll up a bit?
What's that? Scroll? Yeah. I'll do this.
Thanks.
It continues to just pull protons and acts as a base. And so that reaction just keeps on going as a chain reaction. So that's the job of the N-bromosuccinimide. And what we find is that if we do this reaction with N-bromosuccinimide, that it goes 100% to the allylic bromination, and that there is no other reaction that we find that takes place. So for instance, if we take and we react this with NBS and light, that we get 100% of the free radical bromination. So that's where we often see NBS. Now we've used NBS before. We've used N-bromosuccinimide before. The N-bromosuccinimide that we used before was not a free radical reaction. We had used it before to add the bromine and then to use a second nucleophile to get the cyclic bromonium ion is the way that we had used it previously. So it's not a new reagent, but it is a new use for the reagent. Okay, this can get complicated though. and you need to be careful. So for instance, NBS and Light. How many products? Work them out for a minute. See how many products you can generate. Do it on paper. Don't stare at it. Start drawing. See how many different products you can create. Let me know when you figure out how many products you think you got.
I have zero idea where to even start with this.
Okay, that's a problem then. All right, let's take it. And the first thing to do is to decide where are the most acidic protons. What protons are allylic? How many allylic protons are there? So first find the allylic protons and label them A, B, C, D, E, whatever. So see how many allylic protons you can find. Let's call these A. Let's call those B. And that one C. So there are three different allylic positions in this molecule. That is an allylic carbon adjacent to the double bond. This is another allylic carbon, and that is another allylic carbon. So there are three allylic positions. When finding the three allylic protons, if we pull each one of those in turn, we could pull HA, we could pull HB, and we can pull HC. All right, so we're going to say minus, minus, and minus. If we take away HA and we pull one of the HAs, what we wind up getting is a free radical that sits in that position. If we pull one of the Bs, we get a free radical that sits in that position. And pulling HC, of which there is only one, we get the free radical that sits there. So we're looking at the three different free radicals. Each one of these free radicals has resonance associated with it. So we should consider and draw the resonance associated with each one of these free radicals. So it takes just a minute to sit down and to draw out each one of the steps, placing the free radical in the resonance position. Okay. So everybody followed how I've done that now. I mean, I was drawing fast. I'm going to give you guys a minute, but you can kind of see how I've gone through and drawn this now.
So only five exist.
One of them may be a duplicate. Although I don't think so.
Yeah, the bottom right one's the two of them. Oh, no, they're not. Okay.
They're not. There are six individual radicals. Each one of these radicals can now abstract the bromide and make an individual product. So there are six different products that come out of this bromination. So this guy here would give a product that has the bromine there. Bromine there. Bromine in that position. I'm going to bring this guy out over here. That one, and then two from here. And so there are a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 different products that come out of that reaction. So just looking at that, you might not have thought that that was going to be that complicated. And just to clarify this a little bit, NBS and light, 6 products. And so you have to be really, really careful where you decide to do this reaction. And most of the time we do this reaction when only 2 products can be generated, or where there's symmetry and the products are all identical because of symmetry. Because if you choose to do this reaction on something that is asymmetric, you can get a lot of different products that come out of this. So I just wanted to show you the complexity and how you think through a problem like this. How do we go through and actually figure out what all the products are? And it's systematic. So systematically, what I did was I found all of the allylic protons. I generated the 3 allylic radicals. I did the resonance. And then I drew all the products, each resonance contributor contributing 1 product.
Is there a connection? Is HC the most acidic proton?
That's a great question. And I would venture to say that HC is the most acidic proton. Do you want to tell me why you think that might be true?
Because it's not shrouded. There's not I don't know, it just seems like the more acidic proton is the proton that has less other protons around it.
No, not actually. The more acidic proton is more acidic by virtue of the stability of the product that it creates.
Okay, for sure then. So then that was my second part to the question, was that if you take HC, then you end up with a tertiary and a secondary.
That's right. Very good. That's a tertiary free radical, secondary free radical, primary free radical, secondary free radical, primary free radical, tertiary free radical. And so we can look at the nature of each one of the free radicals, and we can address the stability of the free radicals that are created, right? And so yes, what you find here is that you find that there is a primary tertiary, a primary secondary, and a tertiary secondary. And the secondary tertiary secondary, should be the most stable. And as the most stable, that means that its proton would have been the most acidic proton. So it's not about steric hindrance. So it's not always, we don't want to look and say, I think you were getting confused, or you were couching it. I think that you were saying the right thing, but you were couching it in a way that said that the most acidic proton won't have very many protons around it. The converse of that, or the other way to phrase that, is that the most acidic proton should always be linked to the more stable product that comes out of the deprotonation. And that oftentimes is a tertiary, and a tertiary has less other protons around it. But we don't want to go with the blanket statement that the most acidic proton is always the one that has less other protons around it, because that's not true. But in this case, in the way that you were getting to it, your thought process was getting you there. It was just the language that wasn't quite on it.
Right on. Thank you.
Okay. So that was outstanding. Those are beautiful questions. Spot on. Okay. So the crux of this is that we just want to be careful about how we go through and brominate. Okay, there's a lot of other things that they put into this chapter that are about free radicals. A lot of the free radical stuff that is in this chapter has to do with firefighting, anti-free radicals, all different types of consumer products that are free radicals. And most of that, while good information, does not help us with most of what we need to be able to do. So I think that the only other important things free radical-wise is an understanding of some of the dangerous things with free radicals. Some of the dangerous things are products that can undergo free radical reactions. This one is called cumene. Cumene is an organic molecule, a lot like toluene, except that it's highly prone to oxidation by free radical mechanism. And when it oxidizes to an organic peroxide. And this is cumene hydroperoxide. And this is a contact explosive. THF does the same thing, tetrahydrofuran, will oxidize in air. And it will oxidize to make the THF hydroperoxide. Also a contact explosive. All of these organic peroxides are contact explosives. They are extraordinarily dangerous in their solid form when they crystallize. They are extraordinarily dangerous. The reasons that these two reactions go the way that they do have to do with these protons. A free radical, oxygen, can abstract this proton, and what it generates is a extremely stable benzylic tertiary free radical. That allows it to go on to react with oxygen to form the hydroperoxide. THF does the same thing for exactly the same reason. The proton can be abstracted and the structure that gets created is not benzylic, but it is alpha to an oxygen that allows for resonance. And so those benzylic positions and alpha to an oxygen position are molecules that are extremely prone to free radical polymerization. And there's another really common one that is outside of the chemistry domain that we deal with in everyday life. And that is, if we look at fats and oils, triglycerides, and I'm just cartooning a triglyceride here. And what I'm doing is putting in a double bond and sort of tweaking the double bond to simulate that this is a triglyceride, a fatty acid. Or it's not a fatty acid, really. It's really a fat or an oil. And these double bonds, which are here, can undergo oxidation through oxygen. And forgive me, I'm going to copy and paste this so that we don't draw it all over again. And what they do is they form the peroxide in the allylic position. And then this thing smells rancid. And when butter goes bad, when fats and oils go bad and they take on that rancid smell, they're taking on that rancid smell because of oxidation. And that's when the fats and oils go bad. And they are oxidizing in the allylic position to the double bond in the fat or the oil. And it's the exact same reaction as what we've been doing chemistry-wise. So that's kind of cool to link those together. All right, what else do I need to show you here? Maybe a little bit about radical polymerization and then radical stability. So let's do a little bit of free radical polymerization. We don't get a whole lot of use out of this, but it's good to understand how radical polymerization works. Polymers are so ubiquitous in our lives And most of the polymerization that we look at is free radical polymerization, that it's good to know how free radical polymerization works. Most of the time, these are started with a catalyst, such as AIBN and a small amount of heat. And what these do, I'm going to draw it this way at first. So you can see the monomer units. So what winds up happening is the AIBN. AIBN was that molecule, azobis diisobutyl, had a double bond between the nitrogen and a cyano group on the terminal end. And when light struck this, it generated nitrogen gas, and the two isobutyl cyanonitrile cyano-free radicals. There we go. And so this makes a tertiary free radical with a cyano group as a resonant stabilizer. Because remember that the cyano group is actually a triple bond that's here. And so that's a, and I think I actually have that nitrogen in the wrong spot. I want the carbon here, 1, 2, 3, and the nitrogen on the terminal end. So that's a resonant stabilizer. And we get two of those. And we get nitrogen gas that leaves the reaction vessel. That guy reacts with the alkene. And it reacts with the alkene in such a way as to produce the most stable free radical out of the reaction. And so now what we generate is this new bond. Let me do that new bond in red. We generate this new carbon-carbon bond. And that new carbon-carbon bond goes to, it's not at the angle that I want it to be at. I'll let it go like that. It generates that free radical. And that free radical, in turn, reacts with another free radical, another alkene, to generate another free radical. And so this reaction just keeps on going and growing the chain. And so what winds up happening is we get this linking of these chains where they link head to tail, new bond, and free radical. And this just keeps on going. And so the polymer that it creates, when I go back and I look at this polymer, the polymer that it creates is a polymer where the monomer units sit in here. And what we do is we draw this as a repeating unit and a repeating unit here. And we'll say that this group is the monomer unit, and it will repeat n times. And so when we look at that starting material, this starting material is called ethylene. And the polymer is called polyethylene. Excuse me, this is propylene. There we go. And this is polypropylene. For some reason, my brain did two carbons instead of three. And we can see this with any number of polymers. If we start with styrene, then we can take AIBN and we can polymerize styrene and heat, and we put it together in exactly the same way. The way that I would draw it is I would draw each of the aromatic ring systems sort of down and think about taking and making the double bond in a position where they're going to polymerize. And then remove the double bond and link them head to tail. There's the new bond. There's the new bond. And that new bond is going to continue. And that is going to continue. And your repeat polymer sits here and here. There's your end group. And this is polystyrene. Now, these chains, N, can be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of repeat units. And the polymer is just one long, giant chain that then intertwines. And if you take like extension cords and you throw extension cords in the dryer and you turn the dryer on and you go to try to pull out any one extension cord, you can't pull out an extension cord because it's all wrapped up with the other cords, even though it's not connected to them in any way. Just the getting stuck together and wrapped together binds them together into a solid. That's the same thing that these polymers do. If we want an even stronger polymer, then what we can do is we can put in styrene and a small amount of a crosslinker. And now this guy can take and can crosslink the chains and can chemically bond the chains together with a sigma bond. And so we can create crosslinked polymers by putting in alkenes that have two double bonds in them. So there's that part.
So we can make structural predictions or macro property predictions based on these? On the structures that you like, based on the bond strength, like this is an allylic position, it's stronger or whatever.
Yeah, we can't. What we can do is we can base predictions on the solubility of the polymer, the flexibility of the polymer, the rigidness of the polymer, how strong and durable the polymer will be, the heat resistance of the polymer, based on the amount of cross-linking that there is. The more cross-linking there is, the more rigid the polymer is going to be, the more durable the properties of the polymer that the polymer is going to have. The less cross-linking, the more air will be incorporated in the polymer, and the less dense the polymer will be, and the more flexible the polymer will be. So depending upon the amount of cross-linking and depending upon the actual polymer subunit, that determines all the properties of the polymer. And so if they want a more rigid polymer, then they put in more cross-linking. If they want a polymer that is more flexible, then they do less cross-linking. And so you can't really predict per se exactly what the properties of the polymer are going to be, other than through trial and error and knowing that if we just incorporate another 5% of the cross-linker, that we're going to get something that's going to be more stiff and more rigid. And that's what winds up happening. So that's kind of what we get into. All right, so I do want to do one more thing in this chapter. I think we're going to conclude on this chapter without moving into the next section. But so before I do that one last thing, I want to hit this though, synthetic utility. This is what we're getting out of, this is the punchline of this chapter. The punchline of this chapter is really two things. It's being able to take an unfunctionalized molecule, treat it with halogen and light and to be able to functionalize it. That's number one. And we know that bromine is more selective. Than chlorine. Number two, the other really big punchline out of this is that we can take and we can use NBS and light and we can do an allylic bromination. But we need to be careful because we will get multiple products that come out of things. And so, these are going to go through and brominate in the allylic position. As being the tertiary primary is the most stable free radical here. And we wind up getting products that come from each one of the resonance contributors that are generated in terms of that. And that these are going to have consequences when we look at the double bonds. One double bond is more substituted than the other double bond. And one free radical is more stable than the other free radical. And so this sets up a situation where we can have thermodynamic and kinetic. And we get thermodynamic and kinetic selectivity in these reactions. And so depending upon which one of these two we want, thermodynamic is promoted by long reaction times and high heat. The kinetic is short reaction times and cold temps. And we can select for the kinetic or the thermodynamic much in the same way as we did with the eliminations when we did the E2 reactions and we were looking at kinetic versus thermodynamic and the selection of double bonds. Same thing here. We can get kinetic versus thermodynamic and we can select for them. Kinetic being the short reaction times, cold temps, thermodynamic, long reaction times, high temps. And how am I deciding that? I'm looking at the substitution pattern here, that this is tri-substituted. And that equals more stable. And that this one over here is only mono-substituted. And so it's about the substitution patterns of the alkene that are actually generated. So that's the punchline that comes out of this, is really the synthetic utility or the two reactions, the ability to be able to functionalize an unfunctionalized alkane and the ability to brominate in the allylic position. And then that has some consequences and we need to be careful with those consequences. Okay, so there was one more thing that I wanted to cover in this chapter, and there is. Let me think about how I want to cover this. Okay. Let me ask you about a couple of carbocations. Let's do it this way. Can you tell me a little bit about the stability of these carbocations and which one of these carbocations is the most stable?
I'd say B is the most stable because of resonance.
Okay, so B does have resonance. Okay, anybody else? How about which of these are least stable?
Looks like an A might be the least stable.
A might be the least stable? Because no. A... What's that? Go ahead and explain.
Oh, I actually said D.
Oh, B.
D is in dog.
Oh, okay, okay. Now I hear you. D might be least stable. D, why?
There's no resonance and it's secondary.
Okay. Okay, so if we wanted to go through and rank them, we've got secondary, so they're all kind of secondary. But there is no resonance in D. I concur. That leaves me with C and A. What do I do with C and A? How is the oxygen functioning in C?
I suppose it could share electrons somehow by induction, I think.
Doesn't it work in as an electron withdrawing group, not donating?
In C, it actually works as an electron donating group. And there is resonance. So this one, the oxygen, is an electron donating group by resonance. And this is a strong donating group. And this one is actually the most stable. In D, when I look at D, because there is no direct ability to resonate, then what happens in D is that the oxygen in D serves as an electron withdrawing group. So this one is oxygen as electron withdrawing group, and it is by induction. And so this one is actually pulling away electron density from that carbocation, destabilizing the carbocation. And in A looks like it could have resonance if we consider the possibility that I could move the electrons down. Looks like resonance would be okay, but there's an octet violation. And that octet violation means that this is a poor resonance contributor, which then actually turns this into a very strong electron withdrawing group. And so here, the carbonyl is strong electron withdrawing group by induction. And so really, in terms of least stable, this one is least stable. This one is most stable. I'm going to do that in blue. as an electron donating group, and it's bringing electron density into this. And so they're ranked. This is number one, most stable. Number two, because of the resonance. Number three, because of the oxygen electron withdrawing by induction. And number four, least stable, because of the very strong electron withdrawing group from the carbonyl. And so I can rank them in their stability in how they're functioning. Okay. That is a really important skill set that comes out of first semester, being able to look at these and rank these and understanding what is electron donating and what is electron withdrawing, understanding where there's induction and understanding where there is resonance. Okay. The reason that's so critical is because radical stability doesn't follow that. Radical stability is different. And so if this doesn't make sense, then I'm about to really confuse the issue with radical stability. Because what we see with radical stability is that we can have radical resonance that looks like the normal resonance. We can have radical resonance where I have a free radical next to an oxygen. And what happens is the oxygen can donate an electron and the resonance looks different. It can't donate by making a double bond. The oxygen takes on a positive charge and the carbon takes on a negative charge. And the oxygen can donate. So what we're seeing is this directly correlates to a free radical. So this is this carbocation, this allylic carbocation is just like this allylic free radical. This oxygen next to a carbocation, where the oxygen is an electron donating group by resonance, still functions and is a donating group by resonance, but not in the way that we actually expect. So these two are good and okay, just like above. But what's different is, you see how this one here was the worst one? This one was the least stable because the oxygen was an electron withdrawing group because you were stealing electrons and you were creating an octet violation here. Well, when we have a free radical, and that free radical is adjacent to a carbonyl, it functions differently. The electron can push in, and push up. And we end up with the oxygen radical and no octet violation. In fact, that turns this oxygen into an electron donating group. The carbonyl is an electron donating group by resonance. And it's stabilizing for radicals. That means that radicals are stabilized by traditional electron withdrawing groups. And so much of what we understood in electron withdrawing groups as being destabilizing factors is not true for radicals. Radicals are stabilized by both electron withdrawing groups and electron donating groups, which is really cool. radicals stabilized by both electron withdrawing groups and electron donating groups. They're stabilized by both. And so actually the most stable free radical you can have is one that has both an electron withdrawing group and an electron donating group. So most stable free radicals. Most stable free radicals look like this. They have an electron donating group and an electron withdrawing group. And the free radical is in between. So this is an electron donating group, and this one is the electron withdrawing group. And you put the free radical smack in the middle between them. And the resonance contributor, when it contributes to these, looks like this. It has have to figure out how to draw it for you. But it has a Zwitter ion with no octet violation. And extremely stable. So I think the structure that does that, I have to move too many electrons around. I can't do it in one drawing to show you how all the electrons move around. Maybe I won't try to draw it. Maybe I'll just try to show you the systems. So systems that represent these are systems like this free radical. I don't have a name for this one, but most free radicals like carbocations don't have very long lifespans. Most free radicals you can see spectroscopically and then they react so fast that they disappear fairly quickly. This free radical, because it's in between a carbonyl and a nitrogen in exactly the same way as this, this free radical is stable at room temp for days. That would be like seeing a carbocation sitting around for days, which we don't normally see. Carbocations are very, very unstable and react very quickly. Most free radicals are very unstable and react very quickly. But some of them through resonance, we can make them so stable through resonance, through the lone pairs on the electron withdrawing group and the donating group, that they can become stable at room temp for days. Another example, nitrogen in here. Another example has a carbonyl, the free radical, the nitrogen. Very stable. These guys are given names. They're called captive-dative systems. And they contain a free radical that is stuck between an electron donating group and an electron withdrawing group. And then we've got the free radical right smack in the middle. And that just makes them super stable. So the punchline there is that free radicals are stabilized by both electron withdrawing groups and electron donating groups. And they have some differences from carbocations. So we just see a bunch of super stable ones. Okay. That gets us out of the free radical chapter. We'll pick it up on Wednesday with the alcohol chapter. Oh, I think we have some synthesis in between here. We'll do a little bit more synthesis, and then we'll get into the alcohol chapter. We're kind of been using lab to work on that synthesis. And I'll give you guys some synthesis problems. And we'll have a synthesis, a free radical and a synthesis quiz this week too, since we've been doing so much synthesis in the other lab. I'll put together another quiz. So you'll have another quiz that'll be due. I'll set a due date on Friday, and I'll see if I can't get that up and running for you guys today so that you've got lots of time to look at it. And of course, if you need time over the weekend, I understand if that comes in late. And if you haven't turned in the quiz that was due last week, go do that quiz and turn it in. Make sure you do that. All right?
Is there problems that we should work through?
Travis?
Is there like a problem set that we should work through?
Yeah, I was going to look and see what I've got. I've got a free radical quiz. The synthesis problems come in the synthesis chapter, and I think that's where I've got more practice problems. You're going to be using these free radical reactions more than just trying to figure out the free radical reaction itself. You're going to be using them more in synthesis. So I think the practice problems are really going to come from the synthesis chapter. And we're really there. I mean, this is once we get, that's what we're doing in lab right now. That's what we've done the last couple of days. And so I think I would have you start that synthesis chapter and those synthesis problems.
Okay, cool.
That's where I want you to go. So look at the synthesis module, okay?
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Okay, see you guys later.
Jason, really quick, I have a question.
Go for it.
There's nobody else here.
Hang on a second.